live. Dan, nice to see you, man. How are you doing?
Doing all right, doing all right. Here from my live cave, just holed up, avoiding everything in the world, hiding out in my studio.
Oh, nice. Well, I mean, yeah, look, you guys are used to being hiding around in corners, just painting, doing your thing, eh?
Exactly. Quarantine wasn't much of a difference for me. It's really the same thing. Maybe there's more people with quarantining than there was. But yeah, it's for me, it hasn't changed much. It's just the way my lifestyle seems to be anyways.
I read a thing the other day which was funny. It says, you know, I don't have a problem with quarantine. It's the fact that I'm isolated with other people. That's the problem.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. We decided to make the quarantine mistake of getting a puppy right before quarantine started. So luckily, I lost like 4 weeks of my life anyways, and I remember because I was just chasing him around and picking up shit. So that was basically the whole time. So my memory of the coronavirus is really being holed up inside chasing a little puppy around. It's pretty much all I have to remember.
Nah. Just give us a quick rundown of who you are and what you do.
All right. My name is David Loza. I'm a San Diego-based Day of the Dead style artist. I've been doing this now for going on 16, 17 years. I paint all different genres, mostly skeletal Day of the Dead stylings, but apply to different cultures, different genres, from hot rod, obviously motorcycles, to military, to traditional Day of the Dead style, you know, love and remembrance, Western. A little bit of everything in between tiki, you know, if there's rum or tequila or, you know, six guns in something, I probably painted it. You know, it's all that stuff in between. It's really a unique bright colors and dark line work kind of really signify the work. So that work basically, again, Southern California based, we travel all around the world. We've done shows in Australia, in England. It's kind of been taking us all over the place and meet crazy people in Finland. I've been to hot rod shows in all these different places and seen different versions of hot rods. It's really amazing the kind of exposure I've gotten to see, you know, growing up on the East Coast, where it was kind of like, you know, your dad's Mustangs. That's all that existed for hot rods, really. And like Boyd Coddington coupes, that was all that really was. Coming to Southern California and just seeing the rat rod scene early and seeing, you know, just some of the builders and getting to see the stuff I'd never seen before. It's amazing. And then going to Finland and seeing their style of cars, going to Australia and seeing their style, just being everywhere and seeing these hot rod shows. It's amazing how deep it is, how the passionate the fans and the builders are all over.
I mean, the Australians, they love stupid amount of horsepower. I mean, the size of their motors are just absolutely crazy.
And they will drive thousands of miles for a show. It's amazing that they will pack up and they'll drive across the country to go to a hot rod show. I mean, here, if it's more than 20 minutes away, everyone's like, too far. Australia, they'll pack up their children, their whole family, and drive 3 days to a one-day show. It's amazing.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Maybe I should go check out the Australian stuff. Look, my biggest love out of Australia at the moment is that Summer Nats. Have you seen that?
Mm-hmm.
Big watch, 2,000 horsepower, tire smoking. Oh, that is probably one of the coolest things. I have to go see that. But Finland, now, we've actually featured quite a few cars from Finland in the magazine. Mm-hmm. Finland's got a unique style when it comes to building, eh?
Oh, really? It's kind of like the classic 60s paneled, you know, airbrush style, beautiful 60s choppers, you know, bobbers. But it really is a mix, and it's kind of a dash of steampunk. It's really unique. Definitely the stuff I see there was really unique stuff. Beautiful, you know, Palisades quality, you know, showroom quality, anywhere else too. But really a mixture of style. It's kind of like a dash of this, a dash of that. It's really things they've seen and made their own. And a lot of places you see feel like American versions. Like when I was in England, a lot of those feel like a 60s American version. Finland was a little more of a dash of that, but like a weird style, very unique to that Nordic area. It's fascinating.
But what I always love is you. I mean, from the US, it's always like you say, Mustangs, Camaros, you know, and then it's 30s and 40s and stuff. But and it's always Ford, Chevy, Chrysler. But when it hits Finland and stuff, man, they like have Renaults and Audis and all these. They ride the weird the things that you and the cars that were so ugly, but you're like, that's cool.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah, it's like they go in the front yard and they go, okay, that's all I got. That's my hot rod. It doesn't matter what else I see on TV. That's what I'm going to make a hot rod. Yeah, for sure.
We had one really cool. It was like a city style Ford, but the guy ran everything BMW. So the whole drivetrain, everything was modern BMW. It's such a unique build, and like I said, I love the style. I like the fact that it's the you know, we were actually talking about it with some other guys this week. Is that just what you can find?
Yes, there's no rules. They're not locked by the Ford or Chevy guy that we're kind of locked in the States. It's kind of like it's whatever is there. It's whatever I have available to me. It's more like what the traditional hot rods kind of started as, where it's like, you know, guys grabbing parts they had around. And I think that's that spiciness makes it still very interesting out there for what they find. And I think England shares a lot of those same the shows I've gone to there, because their scene is so small, all the scenes come together. So when you go to a show, there's a hot rod section, there's a cafe bobber section, there's a like a 18 wheelers, like custom 18 wheeler section, and then there's, you know, the normal Volkswagen guys. It's a show of everything, and everyone's kind of appreciates all that, because it's kind of like that small community feel, because there's so little of, you know, few of them, that we love everybody. You know, it's kind of like bringing it all in here. And
that's how it works in South Africa, exactly the same. Your biggest show is an amalgamation of everything. So you've got the Mark One or the Cortina Club in the one side, you've got the AC Cobra guys on that side, and then you've got the Hot Rod guys, and you get the American guys, and then the Audi clubs in the corner, and then the Porsche guys pull in. Because look, it's just for the love of car, but it's also to generate numbers.
Yes. You know? Yes. That one group can support itself. It needs the whole community to be a whole.
Oh, that's how you pull your numbers and how you make a successful show. There's been guys that tried to do that in South Africa with like, it's only V8, and I'm like, well, you can't exclude
it. It'll be you and 10 guys sitting around, and that's it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but and also then you end up, I mean, which was the problem, is every show's got the same 10 guys.
Yes. Yeah. Nothing else to do. The same 10 guys are there. Again, yeah. I'm spoiled. I live in an area in Southern California that every, on a normal year before we all sheltered indoors, every Friday there's a show. It's 20 minutes away from me, and it's called Cruising Grand, and it's amazing. It's better than any single day car show I've ever been to in the States anywhere. There's like a whole, like one whole lane will be just Panteras, and one whole lane will be, you know, vintage Fords or maybe late all Plymouths. Like, it's amazing the collection, and there's so many cars in the area that's Pantera is one day, the next day it's Ford Broncos. I mean, and there's 50 of them. You know, cars you only see once in a while on one of the auctions, you know, online or on, you know, Barrett Jackson. I'm seeing 20 of them. It's crazy that the hills in this area, how rich it is in car collecting in Southern California. And that I didn't know growing up on the East Coast. I mean, it was one show on the 4th of July, and that's all we ever saw cars. Here, it's people just drive them around. I mean, we always joke, the Ford Falcon is kind of always a car I use as my story, because I never saw one on the East Coast before. And now being in Southern California, they're just like beat up daily drivers for people who aren't even car people, but they just still drive them. And I've seen... And I've seen modded into race cars. I've seen them into beautiful restorations. I've seen it's like the Jeep of hot rods, where I've seen it in 50 different variants, and it didn't even exist to me till I got out here. It's one of those weird vehicles that just kind of sticks in my mind.
Ah, that's awesome. But now you started your career. You were doing pinstriping, weren't you?
So I kind of grew up in the tiki hot rod culture. Mm. I wasn't pinstriping. I was starting to get into the using the one shot enamels though. In my figurative, I was doing a lot of badge work, kind of like, you know, stuff you'd see on the side of helmets and tanks. Mm. And I was kind of just cutting my teeth in that. And the tiki hot rod scene is where I started. So I was doing all those things and being around that. And when I found enamel, watching these pinstripers work, I was like, oh, that's kind of. I was doing very line work driven paintings. And missing that medium that would let me just kind of freely flow and not have to go back and something completely opaque. And when I found the enamel, it just kind of clicked in my brain and went, that's what I've been trying to do the whole time. So finding those guys just started me in the path to where I am now, where I still use enamel for all my line work. And it just gave me the tool I needed. It kind of completed the puzzle. I went, oh, that's what I've been trying to do all this time. So I was doing hot rod and tiki shows to start with. I moved into tattoo shows too. So really being amongst that crowd, and it's funny, when I go to these places bring me over for shows, it's really hot rod shows from where I started. It's kind of that, because I was in the magazines and all that kind of stuff early in my career, so it's kind of like I'm going over there doing stuff that it's great for me, because I'm so distant from that now. I don't get to as many hot rod shows, But when I go international, I'm surrounded by it. So I get to kind of immerse myself in that scene again. It's great to be where I cut my teeth. I mean, working with Jesse James and those guys is one of the first projects I had. So to kind of do some of those things just kind of goes back to where I started. So it's fun to revisit that and really pay homage to what got me here.
Yeah. We were talking about I had Chris Walker on the show. He's a rat rod builder. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about Jesse James and how fabricating has come back. You know, how the young guys are getting in, they're getting English wheels, and you know, they're really starting to move metal again, and that old school build is back. And Jesse was, he's kind of the father. He's the guy that started that.
He did. For all his faults, he made that sexy again. You know, he made the kind of hand work thing, the blue collar man, he made that respectable to be a welder. You know, before that, welders were the guy, you know, the dirty guy in the corner, you know, throwing sparks around. And he made that cool again. I think he definitely, for all the ups and downs, everything that goes with him, I think that's something that you can definitely hang your hat on and appreciate, that he made fabricating cool. You know, he made it, you know, he funny thing is, he kind of became a link between my dad and people didn't understand what I did in the lowbrow art hot rod scene, because you could go, well, see what that Jesse James guy does on TV? That's kind of the things that we work with. That's the kind of cars. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of people. And it was able to kind of bridge that gap. And again, he was kind of in the beginning. He was, unfortunately, the Orange County Chopper guys were too, the first ones to kind of bring that out and show that off.
Yeah, the Orange County Chopper guys. Saturday morning biker coffee get together, hardcore lawyer.
Yeah, blue toaster to the front of your bike and call it modified. Yeah.
Yeah. What was that? What is that? Roadhogs. What was the movie? Roadhogs.
Yes.
Every time I see that, I just think of Orange County.
Yeah. But that made, again, that kind of inflated the whole chopper scene into, you know, where it just crashed and burned now. It's weird to see that whole, again, I have friends who collect original Orange County Chopper bikes. And I mean, for a while there, they've kind of stabilized now. For a while there, people were just like blowing them out anymore because it wasn't cool. Because everything goes, you know, comes and goes. And again, to see that, you know, Orange County Choppers is closed and now it's, you know, in litigation. It's all, it's weird to see the whole cycle. And now I see guys, making rusty bikes again, rusty bobber bikes I see on the roads. And it's kind of coming back to this hipster style building. But I mean, I don't care what you make. I don't care if it's off camber, weird Toyotas, whatever you do. I love that you make stuff yourself. So I'm not one to judge different groups. Yeah. I like what I like, but I also respect getting out there and getting your hands dirty making stuff, because I can't. I'm a terrible mechanic. I can barely change the oil in my bikes. That's about all I could do. You know, so I respect anyone who can get out there and wrench on their own stuff for sure, no matter what it is.
Exactly. It was just, look, we had it here as well. Choppers just went crazy. I mean, and the prices of choppers.
Oh.
I mean, a bike would in South Africa would just jump like $100,000 constantly. Yeah. All of a sudden, a bike that was like 300,000 was sitting at 800,000-900,000, and then it just crashed. And then the guys that were buying these bikes up at 700,000-800,000, they couldn't even get like 200,000 for the bike.
Yeah. It's like buy one, get one at that point.
I mean, I knew a guy. I met a guy in South Africa. He had a Jesse Rook, and he had it was a few bikes. It was a CFL, one of Jesse's CFLs was here as well. And he couldn't sell them.
No.
He could not sell the bikes in this country at all. And it wasn't because the guys weren't known. It was just
no one wanted to buy. Yep, it became instantly uncool overnight. The cafe racer scene kind of come in, and the bagger scene out here. Unfortunately, which I earlier I said I don't care about. I love all types of things, but I have a hard time with baggers because to me it's there's just so much stuff around them. I like to see, you know, the inner workings. I like grease and oil. I love 40s to 60s machinery. The new stuff I can't get into. It's just, to me, it's too polished. It's too, you know, for me, it's too much of a big package you sit on rather than being part of. I mean, my favorite bike I've had was a 69 Norton Commando, and it was terrible. I mean, you couldn't stop it. The brakes didn't work, but it was so much fun to ride because you felt like you were part of it. It was so simple. If it didn't work, there was one bolt and two wires. I mean, it's easy to figure out what the problem is. And I think I just became attracted to that, where I like the minimalist. I like to, something you can hand make, and even, you know, you can spend, you know, 3 hours online and figure out how to fix yourself. Like, I think I like that. And baggers to me was like a spacecraft. You know, I did some custom ones I painted in my garage years ago, and just parking it in there, it was, you know, 20 feet long. Oh, it's just this crazy, you know, monstrosity of metal and plastic. It's just I could never get into those.
But and then what they're running on these 27 inch front wheels at the moment.
Yeah. One of the custom ones I did had a 27 front, had an iPad molded in the tank. It had, you know, his air ride up and down. It just, to see this thing, it was just amazing, the engineering that went into it.
Yeah, look, I look, it's a dirty pleasure. I love them. I haven't seen them.
This call is over.
I want one. All right, but to me, I'm one of those guys where I'll get it. And then I'll ride it for like a month, and I'm like, okay, I'm over it. Let's do something else. I built
the good thing is if you wait a little while, they're going to drop in price too, just like the choppers did.
I built a with a friend of mine. We built a bike for one of my TV shows, and we found this banged out old 400. I think it was a Suzuki. We found it on like Craigslist.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided to turn it into a bobber, but we only had like 4 days. This bike, and it came out, it was such a cool build. I mean, we had to chop the neck and we stretched it out, you know, because we stretched out the swing arm, and I mean, it was such a cool bike. And then I made the seat out of a skateboard.
Yeah.
And I then decided to ride it somewhere. You know, one, I'm 6 foot, 180 pounds at 400. Did not like me at all. And because I had to change the, you know, to when I stand in the swing arm at the back, we had to change the pivot of the springs. That bike was hard. I mean, after 10 minutes, my kidneys wanted to just climb out. And go, no, no.
You know? I love rigids, but my body will not allow that to happen anymore.
I rode that thing to town. I got back. I got off the bike, and my wife's like, what? I'm like, that's it. I'm getting like a Road King or something. Want something with springs.
I want a gold wing, and I want Everest. Exactly.
But that's not hardcore. I don't care anymore. Okay. I'm getting old.
You pass, exactly. You pass the bell. You pass that curve where it's like, okay, rigid's no more. I like the way they look, but yeah, they look good sitting there.
This reminds me. I had a 49 fleet line, and I had to do this motor show the one day. And my fleet line, I mean, it was like Mac. This is when like the retro style started coming back. So it was matte black with white walls, slam, you know. And I remember I had to drive to this motor show in the rain, but my wipers wasn't working, you know, there's no heat. And I drove there and I got to the show. I remember I climbed out of my car and I feel as bad as hot rodder like you'll ever, you know. I just walked off of Bonneville, you know. I am this cool.
Wiping the salt off.
In the rain. I'm in the car, but I'm soaked, you know, and I'm so badass. And the next thing, my buddy pulls in, and it was the first actual rat rod that was ever built in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I only lived like 30 k's away from the motor show. He lived like 200 k's away, and he drove there in the rain in his rat rod.
Stole your thunder.
And I'm like, you just, ugh, dude.
Can't you wait another hour before you show up so I can enjoy this for a little longer?
Exactly. Stay outside.
Yeah.
But listen, I love your style. I mean, my wife actually got me one of your cell phone covers that you did. And to show how long ago this was, I think it was for my iPhone 6. When it just came out.
Yeah.
All right. I love the work. I love. How did you come up with that? I mean, that Day of the Dead, that's the skull stuff. How did you play? I mean.
So I moved out to Southern California going on 20 years ago. And I was exposed to Day of the Dead. you know, the colors, the pageantry. It was this amazing holiday of remembering your lost loved ones that I didn't have on the East Coast. My upbringing was, if someone passes away, you drink some whiskey, you talk about them for a night, and then they're gone. Like, that's it. You don't do anything else. And this idea of sharing stories about them, you know, their favorite foods, their musics, and every year kind of sharing the happy sides of them, was, I was jealous I didn't have something like that in my life. I would love to have been talking about my grandfather and his favorite music and his, you know, filling in details that are lost now. And I just found that so inspiring. I went to Mexico. I saw the celebrations firsthand, was blown away by how welcoming and warm they were, sharing these with me, being in the cemetery and having families pull me over and giving me shots of mezcal and saying, telling about their loved ones and sharing the stories. It was amazingly moving. And that just started me on this path to, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to portray this Day of the Dead, really kind of be an ambassador for it, share it with other people. It wasn't my own. I wanted to share it, though, and let people find it. And I was so proud of it. And I kind of wanted to make it mine and share it. And I found that, you know, taking that remembrance, the skeletal work, and applying it to other cultures, let me tell stories without getting stuck on, you know, is a person black, white, male, female, you know, blue eyes, brown eyes. You see past that and you just see the motorcycle riders or you see the soldiers. You don't worry about the details. And that lets me tell a more balanced, even story that's really true to what I'm trying to portray. And all those things just kind of came together and just gave me my direction. I was painting before, like I said, hot rod stuff and kind of trying to find my style. And once that all clicked, it was like, out of my way, this is what I'm doing. And it's been the direction now, again, for going on 15 years of this Day of the Dead style.
Oh, that's beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And I agree with you, that culture part. My daughter's favorite movie is Coco. Have you watched the...
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and when I watched it, I mean, I cried.
And it's a great first step to what day that is, too. I was thrilled when it came out. And I could say, because now when people ask me, I used to be the creepy guy doing skulls on the corner, you know, when they saw me. Now they're like, oh, this is that Coco stuff. So I'm thrilled that there's a connection point and something you can learn from. You know, all these people, you know, Middle America's never seen this. Southern California, they've seen skulls and Day of the Dead for years. So now that I'm on shows and people coming from Middle America have seen Coco, like you said, it's great. They have some point. You know, it's not perfect, but it is a great starting point to what the holiday is and to the cultural aspects that it is to Mexican culture. It's thrilling. It's finally like a go-to and not just a creepy morbid guy painting skulls in the corner.
Yeah, well, look, before that, basically, every time you saw a skull, you thought of Iron Maiden and Megadeth. And you know,
poison bottles.
Dark. Dark death metal type of skull type of thing. I mean, that's exactly. You know, badass bikers and stuff. And like I said, yours gave a personality to it. You know, the fact that there's beauty in it at the same time. And then, I mean, those paintings you did, the war ones. I was completely blown away. The ones with the Mustangs and stuff, the planes.
Yeah, and again, the military stuff was funny because it kind of started. I did a World War II piece because I'm a guy, and apparently we're like always studying for a World War II test. It's not going to come, so I was always drawing that stuff. And then I got commissioned to do a piece for a soldier. His wife came to me. He was killed in Iraq, and she wanted to make this painting that he had taken his picture of himself in the truck. And he wanted to make this kind of like a memento for his son. So she wanted me to paint this. So I was thrilled. I didn't know art could be this connection point with people. And that was my first like heavy commission, where there's a lot of weight put on myself to make this perfect. And this was going to be his, you know, his legacy. This kid was going to have this picture of his dad, and delivering that to her and seeing everyone's crying. It's super emotional. But to share that moment, to have his guys, I gave prints to all the guys in his group, you know, to have that kind of point, was the beginning of these commissions that I would do probably five or six for fallen soldiers. And there's nothing like that. It's just to commemorate, regardless of politics, to commemorate something for somebody who's lost somebody, for me to be that point, to be that, to capture that scene, to make this something, a family heirloom that will be passed around and passed down in their families. It's a lot of weight. And I enjoy that. And it was really, for me, kind of a side benefit of art that I never knew was coming. And the military was kind of my way into that. My family is all military. Everyone carries a gun in my family except for me. I carry a beret and a paintbrush. But everybody else, you know, carry guns. That wasn't close enough for me. But capturing these moments kind of pieced it all together. You know, I kind of understood them more. I understood, you know, the life of these people and seeing what they've gone through and kind of understanding how separate it is from the political aspects and the reasons why things happen, but just the relationships. You know, this person was lost and I'm capturing the family heirloom for this child. I mean, those kind of moments will stick with me and have been something that are just so rewarding that you can't express. You don't know they're going to come. You didn't realize that art, not just making cool stuff, but, you know, fun stuff, there's also this other deep side, which you're making something for somebody that they'll have their whole lives. And that's a gift from art that I never knew I would get.
That's insane. That is absolutely insane.
Yeah.
And then you did a tequila as well?
Oh, yeah. We've done some weird relations. I worked with El Jinor Tequila for 3 or 4 years. It kind of started with, I did their, we did a, when you harvest tequila, you use a big, huge flat blade, flat round blade, and you basically chop off the pieces. So 1 year I painted 10 of these, and they basically had an online contest for them, and they gave them away, and each one was custom painted and came in a leather case. I mean, it was crazy. They came to my house in like a wooden crate, like fresh from carving tequila. I mean, they were covered with all the shrapnel and grass. They were razor sharp, so I had to like dull them all down so no one cut a finger off. But working with them, and then I did some internal awards for them for their internal sales groups. And then I designed, we did a full bottle, which was kind of released special edition bottle. And then the year after that, we did a full two bottles nationwide and also worldwide, right in Piccadilly in London. They wrapped the whole windows of the liquor store with a giant piece of my art of that piece. I mean,
oh, that is so cool.
It's really weird for these different things. And I worked with them for, again, probably 4 or 5 years. They flew me out to Kentucky to speak to their sales force and explain Day of the Dead to them. Which is a very strange position to be talking about explaining a culture that isn't yours to another group. So it's something I've really tried to make sure that I'm just a conduit for them to understand. And I'm thrilled you love it. Take what I'm giving you and go learn more. Go research more. Don't let me be where your learning stops. But to be able to do that was kind of like, I remember sitting there in front of the group thinking, I always wanted to be the ambassador. Now I'm like, I'm literally standing in front of people being the ambassador, explaining Day of the Dead. So it's been great to share that. Sunex Tools, we wrapped toolboxes this past couple of years. So doing custom toolbox designs, which got to be at SEMA live painting for the first time. That was really fun to kind of do that and be in a whole different crowd who hadn't seen the work before. So it's crazy to be, you know, just that people who've been following the work for years coming over, connecting it international, because the crowd at SEMA is so diverse. That was a fun experience. And it's always these licensing deals and partnerships, whether it be with a hot rod or be with, a tequila brand. I did guitars for Fender. You know, it brings you to a whole different world. Like I went to the NAMM, which is like the SEMA of music.
Music.
And I get to live paint there and meet that whole crowd. It's really weird to be, you know, this little bubble and just dropped off in these different environments. And I love it. I love to learn and to see and to show the art and to see people's reactions. I paint best when there's just a thousand people around me. When I'm in my studio, I'm slow and I'm playing with my phone. I'm distracted. I work best just surrounded by people making me paint, apparently.
Really? But I mean, so do you normally get there and you've got the idea of what you want to do already? You've laid it out and you start doing? Because I mean, it depends on how many days you're painting for, or do you do multiple pieces?
Yes. So I'm methodical. Like if I'm going to SEMA, okay, I know it's a big show. I want a big piece. And I want people to sit there walk, because that's the kind of show where you walk by the same thing 3 or 4 times. Each day you got your own idea. So I kind of plan for that. I want you, when you walk by, to see progress. You know, I want you to go, oh, he was just on this little part over here, and now he's over here. You know, I want you to see that. So for SEMA last year, I had a big piece on display so you could see what a finished piece looks like. And we had the toolbox wrapped that had that piece. And then I had a large piece for this year's toolbox. And then I had a small piece also, because you got to always make sure that I'm always painting. You know, because I paint fast. Sometimes I blow through what I brought. So I always have emergency paintings ready to go in case I get done, because I'm there to work. And I take a bathroom break and a lunch break, but other than that, I'm painting all day. It's just how I when I'm sitting in that chair, they want me to be there. I want to see every possible person I can see while I'm there. So that's what I'm doing when I'm at the show. But it's pre-laid out. It's pre-sketched out. The background is painted. All the drawing is transferred on there, and it's ready to paint. Like, I'm ready to go. And so everything's laid out, and the paint's already mixed. Like, it's all been thought out and pre-arranged, so I know exactly what I'm doing. Because if you walk by, I want you to see what I do for that 20 seconds you let me take of your day. I want you to see that develop. I don't want you to see me messing around and painting over things or not being unsure. I want my design, everything flushed out, so you're seeing the best of what I have to offer.
Yeah. We had a South African artist on the show beginning of the week, Gavin Collins. And I mean, he's got three art galleries of his own here in South Africa. And he does 200 paintings a year. He sells 200 paintings a year. And that completely blew my mind because I think it's more I blame TV. TV sits and, you know, artists are running around and they're drinking wine and they're doing this. And you know, then they go paint a little bit and, you know, then they've got like 15 canvases are out there to go. You don't think that you actually have to move that amount of part or paint and, you know, product the whole time. Yeah.
It's being a full-time artist is it's a hustle. It is a constant stream. I think for paintings and inkings, I'm probably in the range of maybe 75 in that kind of range of big paintings and smaller stuff for the year. But I have online, I do prints, I do canvas, I do all these different things. So it takes all that to be. And it is funny because the reason I love it goes back to the previous day. I love to paint in public because I have to basically kind of dissolve everyone's notion that I'm either Bob Ross or that I'm this crazy beret wearing wine guy who you can't talk to. You know, it's kind of trying to explain that I'm in the middle there somewhere, but you can talk to me. I mean, I love painting and people will stand right behind me, but they'll whisper like I can't hear them. And I'm out of laugh because I can hear everything they're saying. And I'll just stop and go and I'll jump in their conversation. They're like, oh, I'm sorry. I'm like, no.
It's alive.
Yeah. I can talk and do this. This is what I do. You know, this is no problem at all. You know, and I'm comfortable enough doing this so long that I can paint completely and have conversations. It's my brain just is in work mode, but conversation mode can still happen. And I love being out there because people are just like, what is this? How does this work? What are you? What are you? Why does this all happen? And trying to, you know, explain that just an artist, I'm just a guy, this is how it works, and kind of not be the weirdo in the field who you can't talk to, you know, painting seascapes. This is, you know, art can be everything, and especially for kids when they see this kind of art. Cool art, they think, being done. Like, they don't know where it comes from. They just assume everything is just printed out on a computer, not realizing that things are handmade. So all those things are really reasons why I love to be out there and share in that way to kind of just get rid of the rumors or dispel all the myths of this crazy beret-wearing wine guy.
that is something that I take my hat off to artists, is people, that ability to create, okay? If you look at that, the characters and stuff that you've done. I mean, that is you, and you've done your own design on them and how they are. That thought process of what to put down the whole time. I mean, look, I've dabbled with painting, and I suck. My wife has thrown everything out there that I've done. I says, oh, God. I'm like, can I hang it in the garage? Oh, no, you can't even do it.
No, you put it under the car and catch the oil with it.
But that was the thing that always got me, was that thought process, and that what do you paint? How do you do it? How do you come up with your own design? And if I take it further from what you were just saying about kids, that's the one thing that gets me is, yeah, the imagination part of it. You know, I mean, kids are staying constantly on electronic stuff. I just keep wondering if that imagination part's going away. I mean, I said to my kids the one day, they need to tell me a story, you know, make up a story, and they'll tell you Frozen, or tell you some Disney thing that they've watched, The Lion King or something. They can't just come up with some random story in their head, you know? And that always makes me so sad, because where's that you know, that free thinking, that free thinking of to design it and to come up with it by yourself, you know?
And that's a weird direction. We talk about this a lot, like, you know, I make things by hand. At what point does that not matter anymore? You know, when you could drive yourself crazy as an artist watching YouTube, because you see, like, you know, someone will do like a splatter paint, you know, drip thing, and it gets 10,000, 100,000 views, 100,000 likes, blah, blah. And you could drive yourself crazy trying to chase that, being like, well, here's me hand making something from scratch from my head, and it gets this many. You could just make yourself nuts. But we wonder, like, at what point do people view handmade and digital art the same way? You know, at what point is that? Because if digital art is amazing, it can be amazing. But to me, if the power goes off and your art doesn't exist, you know, there's a little difference there. Yeah. So, but what point is that? No one care. What point is it? Art is the same both. And I'm not one to say that it isn't. But at what point for us is it not interesting that I hand make it versus someone who just digitally uses a filter in Photoshop? You know, what point are those just blended together? And I often wonder about that. And I like being out in front painting, because that's still where I can do what I do. And there's no digital guys out there with their iPads doing that. You know, it's still kind of the round where I can share. Here's what I do. There's no mistake. There's no command Z. There's no undoing this. There's no filter that fixes the screw up I make. This is kind of the way that it is.
And, yeah.
But as young kids grow up, I see it just from the online social media, is that there is a blurring of mattering if it's handmade or not. It's whatever the finished image is all that matters. The technique you got there to doesn't, which I'm not to say that's right or wrong, but for me personally, that's frustrating that, you know, clicking up, Photoshopping and cutting a bunch of images and making one image is viewed the same as, it goes back to like sampling songs. If you take 10 songs and make a song, is that as powerful or as creatively better, who's it aside, but better than the guy who makes his own song from scratch? You know, it's always going to be the argument of both sides. And I sound like the old guy who's like, get off my lawn, you know, when I talk about the digital versus.
That always reminds me.
Going, yeah.
Have you ever listened to Henry Rollins?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he hates DJs. Hates DJs. And he was in South Africa a while back. I've actually got a signed poster of his. And he was talking about DJs, and he's like, you're a thief of music. He says, you take my work and other people's work, and you throw them all together, and you make wiki, and he went to fuck you and fuck your music. I always love that, because to me that's true. And like, that's my whole life has worked with Photoshop. I mean, for design stuff and everything.
Yeah. But
like you say, you're not creating new. You're grabbing pieces that's been done, and you're throwing them all together to try and make something work. Look, there is a skill level. I mean, we worked with a guy on a project called Win My Ride. 18-year-old kid in Mexico. I sent him a mail, and I'm like, listen, I want a BMW 325 in yellow, this body kit, this color, this the wheels needs to look like that. I just threw this, and 3 days later he sends us this rendering of which looks like a real car.
Yeah.
With the motors built in, it's this full 3D. You know, and we can change there is something to that where, okay, that is impressive. All right.
Yeah, completely.
How we can throw that together. But at the same time, it brings me back to guys like Ed Roth and Von Dutch and them. Pinstriping, what you do on the left, you need to do on the right.
Yes. Hey, as soon as asymmetrical pinstriping is a thing, I'm going to be the best, because I can make things not match completely. I can never get them to match up. So as soon as that becomes cool not to match up, I'm going to be the guy.
Exactly. We did a interview with the guy who built built an exact replica of a McLaren F1 LM race car. Mm-hmm. Okay, but I can real driving. V10 McLaren, and he was explaining to us, you know, to sort out where the lock on the door goes. You had to figure out where the hinge on the door goes, where the light goes, and you know, so in order to work out this piece, you need to figure out something all the way from the front. He says, and then once you've figured all that out, you have to do it on the other side. Because same. So that, like I said, that part just blows my mind. where did you get your inspiration? Did you, I mean, did you look at the guys, the Ed Ross and this type of stuff? I mean, when it came to tiki art and that type of stuff, that was their domain. I mean, okay, he started originally with the monsters and stuff.
Yeah. So when I started, I've made a conscious effort my whole career to not paint other people's stuff. No matter I never paint a rat pink. I've never done any kind of, I've done... some early in my career, I did some drawings of a tiki things and immediately went, I don't want to be that. Because there's always tons of guys doing that. There still is today. There was when I started. There's always going to be somebody. And Ratfink is Ed's character. And regardless that his wife will allow you, you can get licensing, you can do it. The Red Roth, licensed stuff. I don't want to do something of somebody else's. I don't want to paint, that stuff, his Fink on stuff and then call it mine and sign it and stuff like that. Like, I never got into that. I love the idea of a character, though, and I love the idea of finding something that's so iconic that it's yours, and that's what I kind of made my mariachis be my iconic thing, kind of be my stuff. But it was a constant battle being in the tiki world and hot rod culture. People wanted me to paint that. You should do a Scully Fink. You should do a Scully. I get it, but I just tried to. I never did. I want to stay, stay true to my stuff, and I realized quickly doing Day of the Dead stuff, it had to be different. It was going to have to be my own. And that's kind of why I don't do flower face girls and the stuff you see in tattoo stuff now. I knew that that would be a crowded market when I started 15 years ago, that everyone would be doing that. And it has come true that that's what everybody does. I wanted to make mine different and capture, moments in time I wanted to show. Things like, samurai, things I always found amazing, heroic, I wanted to be able to portray with this Day of the Dead style filter. So for me, all these inspiration for pieces, I kind of searched deeper and farther from what those people were doing. It just felt crowded. I wanted to stick out. I started doing shows when I started doing art. So the only way I was showing myself was always surrounded by 50 other artists. Well, I wanted to be different than those 50. They're all kind of doing the same things. The only way to stood out, I thought, was to be totally different. So I kind of separated myself. And eventually I would stop doing tiki and hot rod shows altogether and move towards more of the galleries and art festivals and art shows, because I wanted to elevate what I was doing. I wanted to try and be better, make things bigger stories rather than single characters. I wanted to do full elaborate tales and capture history, whether it be military or the samurai. For me, my inspiration was just, old movies and things that inspired me as a kid, kind of all bouncing around in there. And at this point in my career, I can paint anything I want. It's amazing that I have the freedom. It could be a diver, underwater diver versus an octopus today. And tomorrow it could be angels and devils. And the next day it could be hot rods. I mean, I have so much in my head. I'll die before finishing all the paintings I want to get done. I have a list on my phone of 20 paintings in line, just waiting to do. And the problem is that I'll look at that list and then some crazy idea will just come in and push its way to the top. And then I'm painting that. So the list never goes down. It just stays there of things for me to paint. And it's kind of like one sentence things like, the cowboy doing this or a motorcycle doing that. And I kind of build this library of things in my head I want to paint that. I mean, I never have idle hands. I always want to be doing work. So there's so much laid out for me. So I've never had painter's block. I never allowed myself to, because as an artist, you don't know when your next paycheck's coming from. It's only what you can go hustle. So I can't sit around going, I don't know what I want to paint. I don't feel like painting. You don't get to do that. It's not a luxury I have as a full-time artist. So I've been full-time with no other job except for the art now for 15 years. And it's a scary proposition, as you go the leaps and bounds, as the economies, you're sensitive to everything. But to see this kind of solidify that this is what I do now. And even at 15 years, I still don't know where the next check comes from. But we've been able to survive and do this and never had to go back to get day jobs. And this is what I do. And my girlfriend's full time. She manages the art business too. This is all our little business, our little world that we've created. Yeah. I feel so inspired still.
But that must have been scary when you decided to do that pivot from the hot rod shows and the tiki shows and stuff to go gallery. I mean, look, that shows enormous growth as an artist. That goes from well, I'm doing this as a hobby to this is what I do. This is who I am.
And I only had a full time gallery as of 7 years ago, where I have a full gallery that carries my stuff. I have one gallery that I work with. I never liked galleries, so I did gallery shows, but never like full gallery until about 7 years ago. So before that, it was like doing art festivals, and I did all of them. Every vegetable festival there was, strawberry festival, avocado festival. I mean, I was everywhere doing fine art shows, basically kind of learning who my crowd was, learning what works, just learning the business of art, learning how this, you know, how do you make a dollar? How do you pay the rent, pay the mortgage? How does that, those pieces go together? And painting live really started to mature because I realized how important it was for me to be out front, sharing the work live at each show. And it kind of built, you know, me as a person. I was able, I can, you know, freely talk about my work with people. Kind of, it's like education for those 5 or 6 first years to kind of get good at being an artist, not just the art itself, but the business of art and learn what that means. And it is scary as shit that first, when you quit that day job and those insurance benefits go away and you're now a full-time artist, it was a very scary moment in our lives. And I remember those first 6 months, we booked every show. I had that first year, I think we had 40 shows in 52 weeks. I mean, it was that kind of crazy where I did everything. I did farmers markets. I did all this stuff because I wanted this to work. I wanted to give it a try. And I knew I had to jump in with both feet because I may not get another chance to try this again. So it was I'm glad I got to the other side, but there were some lean times. I mean, motorcycles had to get sold to sell tax bills. It's how things work sometimes.
I've sold all my hot rods, bikes, everything just to try and keep my magazine and stuff going. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have the toy, but when the bills beneath you get paid, then, you know, they go. Because you know you can always make another one.
Exactly. And things like your magazine and my art, like, they're not, people love them, but they're not important for daily life. You know what I mean? They're not essential. So it's weird to think of that I do this thing that people don't even really need. I mean, they love and they want, but at the end of the day, like, food, I'm like 400th on the list of things they actually need, you know, and I'm sitting over here going, please remember me, you know, will they ever stop remembering me? It's a weird spot to be in, to be fully attached to the art and live and die by it. And luckily now, 15 years in, the anxiety has settled a bit, and I know that this is going to work, and I know how it works, and I have a good feeling for it, but there's still, you know, there's still super highs when an email comes in with a partnership that wants to work with us. And there's super lows where I spend a whole chasing 600 different thefts online of different stolen stuff. I mean, it's all those things, but it's settled in now at year 15 to be like, okay, I should sit back and enjoy a little bit, you know, celebrate this. You know, like I said, when you create something like a magazine, when you create those things and no one else did, you're the only person that made this thing happen. You need to celebrate that stuff because only you will appreciate everything that goes into getting there. Everybody else just looks like, I said, oh, look at the guy who made a magazine for fun. Oh, good. That's fun for you to kill your spare time with, you know, those kind of things. But only you know how much went into that stuff.
Yeah, it's what the Thursday night, you send the thing off to print at 12 o'clock the Thursday night, and you're like, there, Friday morning, like, let's start again.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And people will go to you, oh, that's fun, you have your little hobby, and you made some picture pages about it, that's fun, good for you, you know, you just strangle those people.
Are you worried now with after the virus, with, you know, financially and the, you know, what's happening, if it's going to affect the art market that much?
Definitely. The good thing about this was, strangely enough, being an old man, I was kind of prepping for getting off the road and not doing as many shows anyways. You know, I was kind of, we've been building the business. The idea of the business was always to be home more, you know, to celebrate and basically be online and do a few shows here and there. And we'd actually moved to that. At this time, right before the COVID broke out, I was only doing probably 6 shows a year, down from, you know, at one time, 30, 40 shows a year. And even those shows, you know, we've had issues, you know, we've had stuff happen at shows where, whether it be COVID or mass shootings, things have happened at our shows that were making us want to be out there less and less, you know, so this was perfect timing in a way where I was already, you know, 70% online anyways. So I think for us, we're very prepared for this. You know, my girlfriend, who's amazing, before I suckered her into doing the art market stuff for me, she was a full-time online marketing. Like, this is what she did, advertising, marketing. So she's this amazing resource I have in-house, you know, that can do all this stuff. And for 15 years, she's been guiding this ship, you know, knowing how to do all this. So we were ready for this. We're kind of, you know, but for my friends who are so dependent on shows, I don't think shows will ever be the same. I still have shows that I'm booked for that I don't think I'm going to do because I don't know how it all levels out. Either the people won't be there or, you know, you're in a booth wearing masks and gloves and, you know, interacting with 100,000 people over the course of a weekend. You know, it's just, it's so much exchange. What, are we going to be behind a plastic shield? I mean, it just makes for, I can't like paint anymore. That's for sure. You know, it's, you've taken away these things that made the, what I did so important. I don't want to do a scaled down, crappier version of my booth out there, my experience, you know, it's,
no, they're going to put you in a plastic bubble.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, throw pennies at the monkey inside the bubble. I don't know how it all. I don't know how shows come back. I know they will eventually, but for the next year or two, I'm going in with a mindset of, okay, I need to prepare for them not being back. And if they are, the opportunity will be there if I want to go do them. But how does my life look without shows? Because that's what I have. This is what we have to do here, and this is what life looks like. Because I know that the festivals and stuff that I'm dealing with, I mean, everything for me is canceled up till December right now. But in December, I'll have to make the decision because they're going to have shows, you know, that I do in Arizona. If those shows happen, do I not do them? And once I don't do shows, you don't get to go back to those shows. They don't welcome you back if you cancel. So it's kind of like they're forcing you to make that decision. So someday down the road, I'll have to make that decision and figure out where my career path is. And it's very unique to each artist because, again, we have an online following. We've built this whole thing that way because we both came from the online world. So I knew it was important. I love sharing, and whether it's doing live streams or sharing video, time lapse, like I'm kind of built for quarantine. So if it stays this way, that we can do that. I just don't know how, I don't see a path for shows right now in the next year anyways. I'm sure it'll all flush out in a couple of years and it'll all get back to normal. But for the next year or so, I don't know how you can have, as an artist, put yourself in a booth. It's one thing for people because they can wear a mask when they go to a show, or just they can do their anti-back and be careful as they navigate the show and look in the booths. I have to be sitting there with each transaction and dealing with everybody and everything the entire time. And, it's, and for us, it's too big a risk at this point until things flush out and we get an idea what the long-term, you know, effects of this are. And I feel bad because I have lots of artist friends who do nothing but shows like I used to, where they got 30 or 40 shows and they're all canceled. And they haven't done any online because the shows were their livelihood. So, I mean, it's really upending. I think when those shows come back, I think there'll be a huge turnover to artists who are gone now and can't even come back. And a lot of new artists maybe trying to. It's a really
complete
shift. I think it's very unsettling. And I don't think I can see shows for months, if not years.
The guys I feel sorry for at the moment, and I've got a lot of them, are tattoo artists more than others. Because, I mean, you can get an email, talk to someone, do a painting, paint it, wrap it up, and send it to them. I mean, the guy can't just send you his arm, you know?
I know. And you're right. I mean, that is right there. And health officials across the state, California in particular, I mean, that is a pinpoint laser scope they're using on those guys. And they will be under the hardest of strictest of rules as they reopen. And you're right. There's nothing they can do. And they don't want to go back to being garage scratchers. You know, they want to work in their studio. And they are kind of stuck in that middle ground of, how is that ever be safe again, you know, for a while? They're in that weird, how is it clean? How do you make sure, you know, and that's the livelihood. And there's no, like I said, not built for anything else. You know, exactly. Tattoo shop is what it is. And they're nomadic by nature anyways. And they have a place. I can't imagine having that upended like that. Cause it's going to be a while before it goes back to norm for sure.
Yeah. World is a crazy place at the moment, man.
Yeah. It's just so uncertain. Everything's kind of up in the air and it's loud and it's all these things.
So I've had you on the show for like over an hour. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you, man.
No problem. I got my jammies on. I got nowhere to be. Locked down.
I love your work. I've always loved your work. I need to order some prints and stuff from you to put in the house. Definitely, because I think someone stole my phone with the cover on it. the box of artwork that I had from you, which was the one with the two bikes, like the old
The board track. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Absolutely love that one.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. As you were talking now, you talk about the samurai and that type of stuff. The visually, they each one of them. It's amazing how art can do that. Visually, every painting is jumping in front of my head.
That's how my head is all day.
I can see the detail in it, and that's like, so like I said, man, I love your work. Definitely.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that.
So you have a good evening, and have fun. Thanks, man.
Yeah, take care, man. See you later. Bye. Yeah.